Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years, providing solutions for sports field managers.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good morrow, all of you who are listening. This is the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, and on today's show, we're going to talk about syringing and how it can affect both high and low maintenance level fields on our high-low segment.
And we're not talking about drugs. In our Out of the Park segment, we'll be talking with Larry DeVito, head groundskeeper with the Minnesota Twins, about ball speed, and we're all concerned about that.
And we'll have all of that and more on today's edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast.
And welcome back again, everybody. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. And I'm joined by Teresa Beyer once again, my very talented co-host and producer of the show. Teresa?
That's probably the nicest way you've ever introduced me, Paul. Thank you. Hello.
Oh, come on. I've done better than
that. Well, that was the least silly and the most sincere.
It's getting hot out. It's a little toasty and humid here this afternoon and as we do our show. And that brings to mind trying to keep our turf grass cool and sassy.
Cool and sassy. I like a sassy turf grass. It plays the best. If my turf grass isn't sassy, I'm not doing my job right. You're absolutely right. As we start piling on the stresses, you know, because usually we don't get hot without also getting dry, without also getting extra wear because everyone wants to be on the grass. You know, it all adds up.
Well, and we're certainly starting to see some of the dryness start creeping as the heat has come up here. We've started getting much more active in watering at my facility. We don't do a lot of syringing in my place. In fact, we don't do, you know, at least from an irrigation standpoint, that kind of syringing, we don't do much at all. That was more something I did in the professional levels. In our level at our little league complex, we barely have enough time to water the fields as it is. We've got a manual irrigation system, so we're always trying to find time to squeeze in some watering for that.
That's a good point to start with. There's a couple of different ways of thinking about syringing. There's the syringing cycle on the irrigation heads, and then there's the way that the golf course guys do it, which is where you do it by hand with a hose. Yeah. And my daughter thinks that that's the superior method. And she's correct.
Apparently. She's syringing right now, I think.
She might be.
It was very common for us at Oriole Park, you know, when we had the sand-based field, for us to have to go in there and do syringing, especially when I'd get caught. And this frequently happened at day games. You know, we'd water the night before, but, you know, you'd get in days in May in Baltimore where it can get really hot and really low humidity, you know, down in the 20% range before the summer humidity has really set in, and you'd get, you know, relative humidities in the upper 20% range. You were losing water fast. And there were, you know, many times over the years that I was there that I'd be out there pregame watering the infield dirt, and I'd look over and, you know, an area of the infield suddenly was starting to get that blackish hue to it, showing that it's, you know, getting a little hot there and a little dry. And, you know, normally you don't want to put water on your grass, especially your infield grass, just before the game because it makes the ball slippery for the infields. But, you know, once in a while I'd have to slip, you know, and give it a little shot to get it through the game. And it's surprising, you know, how far that would get the grass, just given that little quick spray or syringing of the grass that you could get that back to color and it'd carry you through most of the game. Just that little bit of water. It was quite interesting. But, you know, at the little league levels, we just don't have that time during the day. It's whatever you get time for at night or in the early mornings before games start that we could do anything.
Yeah. And you know, you bring up a good point. There's a couple of different things that syringing can do, and the way you're talking about it is actually feeding the grass water. The hand syringing that you do with a hose, rather than running the irrigation cycle, is more about temperature and about changing that temperature interface where the turf grass meets the air. And the idea is not to actually get the grass wet at all, but rather for the mist to evaporate before it hits the grass leaf, and that changes the temperature right around it.
Yeah, you're basically doing the same thing. You're looking for that evaporative process
right.
to help lower the temperature right at the turf canopy is what you're doing with syringing. In my case, I was trying to, you know, keep it so it was turgid enough and it looked decent enough color-wise that we didn't get that blackish hue of it starting
right.
to go to heat stress.
Well, that's the other part of that is that you're putting that cold water, and when you do it on the irrigation cycle, you are getting that cold water, or if you slip a little bit while you're working on your infield, you get that cold water down to the root system, and that cools down the roots. And actually, there's been a lot of research done in the last 10 some years ago where they were looking at the actual temperature of the roots, and you do need to have the roots to be within a certain temperature range for the grass to function at optimum levels. And so you're exactly right. You're getting a couple of different factors. You're allowing the grass to perk up on the top side, or you're changing the temperature of the root zone. And so there's a lot of different things that can be done with that. And it's a fascinating process if you have the time to be able to take a look at it.
And I would challenge that theory on cooling the root zone, because sand is such a heat sink. You can pour water on it all you want. It's not going to last very long.
It does not last very long. You are correct. It's meant to be a shot in the arm.
Very short time.
Yes, absolutely.
As far as I'm concerned, syringing does more benefit for the turf canopy than it does for the turf roots.
Depending on how you use it, I can see that absolutely. And speaking of the benefit, you know, what benefit does this have on a low maintenance field? And I would say, I don't know that it has very much benefit. It was kind of what we were talking about beforehand, where no, you may not syringe every day, or you may not want to make it part of your regular maintenance program. But if you've got a special event coming up, knowing how to syringe properly can really take you up a notch, take you up as far as the way that the field plays and the way that it looks when you do have that special event. And it can really give you that extra, I don't know, that extra shot in the arm, that extra oomph that you might want to have for that special event. I don't know. I've been thinking about it. I was wondering, because we talk about some of these other maintenance practices that might be able to get us over the hump of a stressful period and all of that. I don't know that syringing is one of those necessarily, where it can save you over time if you need to delay. Let's say you know you've got to resod, or you need to renovate and you need to put that off as long as possible for budgetary reasons. I don't know that syringing saves you there. But understanding some of the different techniques in watering might be able to.
For a park and rec or a tournament facility, you know, I think you're right. To make the place look extra good for a big event, a big tournament or something like that, I think there is benefits to that. And not only that, but it also, I think, helps that turf withstand some of the wear and tear that it's going to take.
Yeah.
Because you know, anytime you take away a stress from a turf, it's going to handle the wear that it's going to go under much better than if you have it under stress and it goes through the additional stress of playing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So
Absolutely.
Anytime you can remove a stress, you're certainly helping that turf grass plant. But in most cases, you know, for most people that aren't in the professionals, you know, you're not gonna do too much syringing, but it's more for the people of special events or you're up at the higher level where they're expecting that that perfect field to always be in place. The other people have so many other things to worry about with time management and their resources that syringing is not going to come into play. But
it's a high intensity practice.
Yeah, but syringing does have a lot of great benefits if you get it. And to close this out, let's just say that you know, if you really wanted to put a definition on syringing, it's basically, you know, whether it's by hand or mm-hmm. it's by an automated irrigation system, you're putting a very light amount of water. You know, for instance, on an automatic irrigation system, you might run it for what, 5 minutes? And it depends on your heads too, because if you've got speed heads,
yep.
you know, sprinkler heads that turn very quickly, you know, you're talking about maybe twice around,
yep.
Or three times around real quick to put some water down. You're just trying to cool that canopy off. And what you've done is you've created the, you know, it's the same as a human sweating. You sweat so that hopefully that sweat will evaporate. And by doing that, that cools your surface. You're doing the same thing
exactly.
with the turf canopy.
Yeah.
So that's what the science is behind syringing. So now that we've argued that to death, let's take a commercial break because we need one here. And we'll be right back with Larry DeVito from the Twins.
I know that guy.
Innovation. That's what we're all about at Beacon. We spend each summer out on fields working with field maintenance equipment, and from that come ideas. Our engineer takes those ideas, develops them, perfects them, and then we test them. Not just once, but daily at our field maintenance research facility. We work out as many bugs as we can while we evaluate the product. Once perfected and the desired performance is achieved, we give it our Beacon-built stamp. That's how we've developed such revolutionary products as the Streamliner Chalker, the Sweet Spot Tamp System, the Phantom Batting Cage, the Beacon Field Weights and Tarp Cart, the Adjustable Weight Nail Drag, and the list goes on and on. We live and breathe sports field management. We walk the walk, and we talk the talk. Don't you think it's time to give Beacon a look? To request a catalog, give us a call at 800-747-5985 or make a request from our website at www.beaconathletics.com, where our web store is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year long. And we're back, and we've invited Larry DeVito, head groundskeeper for the Minnesota Twins, in to talk with us today. You'll know them also as the husband of my co-host. Larry, today we're going to be talking about managing infield ball speed, which you've done an article recently. I believe it was in Sports Field Management for that, right?
Yep.
Yes, or Sports Turf.
Sports Turf Management, sorry. And it's an excellent article. We're going to get a link for that.
I will link to it. Absolutely.
Yep, on our notes page.
It's called Managing Infield Ball Speed for anyone who wants to look
it up. And if you get a chance, read it because it's an excellent article. But we're going to touch on a bunch of the things today in our interview. So, Larry, first of all, of course, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today. So, managing infield ball speed, your article was pretty complete, in my opinion, as far as all the different things you covered. Let's go through some of the factors then, Larry, that you were talking about in the article. And I guess we'll start out with what I was just chatting about, starting with, you know, what are you growing your turf in? And in your situation, the bulk of your article, you talk about the sand-based version of it. So why don't you give us a little touch on that, about the significance of your sand-based field and how that affects the ball speed.
Sure. You know, it goes back to, you know, at Dodger Stadium, we had a 100% sand-based field with a PAT system. And, you know, the field, we were mowing it at the infield generally at 3/4 of an inch, whether it was, you know, Bermuda or we were playing on the rye, or the one year where we changed it to bluegrass, we seeded bluegrass. But regardless of the type of turf, we were always around 3/4 of an inch. And the comments we get from other teams would be, well, it's fast, but it's consistent. And by that, they meant, you know, the ball didn't pick up acceleration off the turf. And we had a nice correlation between the turf and the dirt and how we managed it all. Part of that was the sand itself. Part of that was Eric's management program. It all kind of came together. So you know, you can mow at a low height and on the sand base field and not have it play too hard, obviously. So, you know, then in Washington, I had a whole different thing going on. You know, like inherited a Bermuda field at RFK that had a sand that had some, that was pretty good for baseball. It was a little maybe softer than we wanted for soccer. And then at Nationals Park, we went with kind of a dirty sand, and it, the CU was about 3.2, and that was a little firmer than I liked. So, you know, I kind of took all that information together when I got to Minnesota and worked with the architect on what we wanted to do here.
So just a quick note for the listeners. The CU is the coefficient of uniformity, and that's talking about the particle sizing and how uniform the different particle sizes are within the sand itself. In your article, you talk about the ASTM standard guide for construction of sand-based root zones for sports fields, and we will have a link for that as well.
Great. Yeah, that's a really valuable resource if you're building a field.
And you found that you preferred having the CU, well, I forget, was it at around 4?
No.
Or
no,
below 4?
Well, yeah, definitely below 4.
Yeah.
I'm below 3 here.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've ranged, you know, 2.7, which, you know, was a little concerning. It is, you know, on the new field, really, until you get that, you know, that root zone established. But at the time, we were doing a early September install, and we weren't planning on it until April. You know, and then you get into repairs, and you're using thick cut sod, and that kind of mitigates that. So,
right.
It's been good. I mean, there's other issues with professional athletes in terms of the, you know, these guys play every day. You know, if a field is too hard, they start to feel it in their joints or their back, and all the comments you get from guys playing on synthetic turf about how it beats up their body. It can, you know, if you have a natural grass field that's too hard too, and you're, you know, 33 years old and you're playing 6 days a week on it, you can start to feel that too. So all these things kind of come into effect.
Now, obviously, the CU is probably more important. Well, it's not probably. It is more important in a sand-based field than it would be for a native soil field. You're not going to look at that typically as much in a sand-based field. Or, I mean, I'm sorry, a native soil field.
Right.
I got mixed up there. Take two.
Well, you know, it still would be important to know, I would think, Paul. I mean, you can't necessarily affect it as much. You can't make a lot
correct.
Of changes, but it might be good to know. It could affect some of the other things that you could do if you're playing with a high level of even with kids, you know, if you've got some of those traveling teams in, you've got high level players. No, you can't change your coefficient of uniformity, but if you know that it's low, if you know that it's high, if you know that you have a hard root zone, if you've got a more sturdy root zone, you can do some other things as far as your grass management and some of that is concerned in order to affect the ball speed.
You can, but of course the percentages of clay and silt are going to play largely into that almost as much, if not more so, because they can counteract whatever the CU is
good
doing
point.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
So,
exactly. Yeah. And if you send that out and get tested, the physical analysis, then you have a resource to go to get
exactly
your budget for deep tining and doing things to improve the playability
soften it up.
Of the field.
Okay, so the soils are one thing you're looking at. How about, of course, you know, you're talking about being in LA and you had basically grown three different types of grass there at some point in time. The type of grass that you've got on your infield are also going to play a role in the speed of the ball. So let's touch on that for a little bit.
Sure.
Which one did you prefer when you were in LA? And why?
I preferred perennial ryegrass. It always seems like, you know, in the spring in LA or in Washington before we transitioned, or you know, I had 1 year here where in Minnesota where we, after a Big Ten tournament, we overseeded with a good amount of blue and rye, and the rye kind of took over. But with rye, it's the reason soccer guys like rye so much is the ball moves across it a little faster, and with rye, the foliar program was more effective on rye than it was on bluegrass. So in the summer, I felt like I had a little more control. The uptake with the rye is better than it is on blue, on the finer blade of the rye grass. That's just a personal preference, though. So.
You use a lot of liquid fertilizers, right?
Oh yeah, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, a lot.
Yeah.
Well, spring we'll be using granular a little more
Especially if you're dealing with a sand-based field, typically you're going to use more foliar applied fertilizers than you will granular anyways. When we asked the question, which grass did you prefer, I would have sworn you were going to say Bermuda, because most guys will say, oh, Bermuda, you can get it really tight and really fast. And so I was kind of shocked.
That's my preferred.
You know, the other thing that's interesting, if you talk to Andy McNitt from Penn State, he'll tell you makes recommendations in most situations that really you shouldn't even be messing with bluegrass and just going with straight rye on your athletic fields in the northern climes.
Yeah, and that's what we were surprised about when we moved up here, learning that ryegrass doesn't kill off as easily as you would think it would in the really cold temperatures.
Yeah.
There's winter factors. I mean, if you have a winter where with no snow cover and extreme cold, the rye is going to be toast. But if you can get some snow cover and I think what I've learned up here from talking to people, if the rye goes into winter mature, you know, if you seed it in September,
right,
it's more vulnerable to winter kill. But if it's mature, it's got a chance.
Yeah.
So.
But, you know, his thinking is that, you know, it takes so long for bluegrass to not only germinate but mature.
Good point.
And by that time, and most people, a lot of guys will use a blend of blue and rye, the rye's already overtaken it. And, you know, he said it just takes that much longer for it to become strong enough. And so he's pretty much a proponent of using a ryegrass on athletic fields. And after listening to him, I thought to myself, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. but you can't deny the repairability of bluegrass and just the durability of bluegrass.
Yeah, it's very durable. Well, so thinking about the grass, it also comes into how you're watering it and keeping it, you know, we're going into the summer. It's getting ready to get drier up here. It's getting ready to be a lot warmer, not like it was down in LA or DC. So what is the difference that you see as far as the cultural practice and the watering and the infield ball speed?
You know, when the team's on the road, I water a little more according to the turf textbook, you know, deep watering and separate the number of days, or hope for a good heavy rain like we got a couple nights ago without the tarp on. But that's, you know, that's by chance. So it's not really a set program. You're hoping the team's out of town, and you're hoping you get, you know, that heavy rain where you can get some natural rainfall. And you know, the challenge up here with our irrigation water has just been having to inject whatever I can into lower the pH.
Yeah, so, we have very hard water up here and very high pH on top of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, but in terms of during a homestand, Los Angeles was a little more consistent than unless it was Sunday, we played at night. But Minnesota, our game times are all over the place, you know, and we'll go from two night games to a noon game to a 7 to a 3 to a 1 back to 7. So, you know, you kind of take that into effect and not wanting to water too close to batting practice, basically. So I've tended to water a little more after games at night, which, you know, from a disease standpoint is a little risky, but what I do is if it's sticky out, I say, you know, it's kind of a touch and feel thing. So I've got to play with the dew points and play with the schedule in terms of having enough for dry down, because if I give it a good watering in the morning, you know, we have batting practice some days starting at 2 o'clock, and you know, you can start to get ball marks. You know, it's a little spongy,
right.
But at the same time, I don't want to go into a day game with it to the point where I'm going to be wilting by the eighth inning. You know, then it doesn't play very well, and it's not really what I'm trying to do.
But it does happen. I mean, I've had games where I'm sitting there in my office looking at the field out my window going, oh, crap, it's looking awful black out there right behind the pitcher's mound.
Oh, yeah.
And there's nothing you can do. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're probably the only one who notices it because you're at the right angle, first of all, to pick up the color change. But but it drives you crazy because, you know, oh, my God, I got to get water out there. Or, I mean, I've had it where I'm out there pregame water when I was in Baltimore, and you'd start to see the black develop you know, starting to go, and you're going, oh, crap. So you just hit it real quick with some water. You know, even though it was on the infield grass, you wanted to protect it a little bit and try to hold on to it for a little while before it got too bad during the game. But, you know, you do something similar, though, to what I did is that, you know, during homestands, we watered our foul territories near the infield and the infield grass all by hand during homestands. We didn't leave it to the irrigation system.
Yeah, and part of that is just, you know, a higher level of management, and part of that's the tarp. You know, especially the foul territory, you know, part of it's under the tarp and part of it's not.
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, we got to water here. Probably the one area where we tend to have stress on a hot day game over the course of the year a couple times is that area, the triangular
behind
area
base.
Behind second base. Yeah, oh, that's tough. That's a tough spot. You know, because the outfield's getting water, and then you got to get out and hand water that, and we always struggle with that. You know.
Now you were talking about ball speed again, going back to the types of turf, and you said something interesting about what Eric did in Los Angeles, where during homestands he would actually mow the Bermuda down a little shorter, and let it come back up then during the homestands.
When they were on the road, we would mow it shorter.
That's what I meant to say. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's what I meant
to
say. And then you let it come back up for the homestands, which makes sense because, you know, one of the things you battle with Bermuda grass and southern grasses is it can get pretty spongy pretty easily as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That puffiness is, you know, for an elite professional athlete, for a baseball or soccer, if that Bermuda's puffy, it's not, the ball does not move across it very nicely.
Yeah, it starts grabbing the cleats too.
Yeah.
So the things you do to combat that were to mow it down then during road trips. How about verticutting and things like that? Obviously, that had to play a big role as well in keeping your ball speed up.
Didn't do a ton of verticutting. I think he felt that we had groomers on the triplex. We'd utilize those.
Oh.
And the core aerification. So we didn't, you know, it wasn't a case where we, in a regular top dressing program, you know, so it wasn't like, oh boy, we're going to verticut, you know, this week and it's going to be a big mess.
Right. It felt like keeping up for a couple days.
Yeah, keeping up on the other cultural practices kind of kept it under control. So it would be, let's say the team would be out of town for 8 days the morning after the homestand. You know, there's a couple mowers going in the outfield, and we get it all mowed down, and then from there, okay, what are we going to do? Are we just solid tining or coring and dealing with that? And then leading into the homestand, hit it with, you know, some soluble nitrogen and really just get it to pop. So it worked pretty well. It was impressive to watch.
Well,
go ahead, Paul.
I was going to say, you know, which is a good segue right into the next section of looking at ball speed is fertility.
Get out of my head, Paul. Well, no, I do want to talk about the fertility. It's interesting. I mean, because it's a different philosophy than when you're looking at a native soil. But at the same token, there are some really good things, some good takeaways here. You use a higher potassium ratio, and we've talked about that a lot because you have a specific sand that is just seems to hate potassium, and it just will not hold on to it, and you've had to put a lot of it down. I've seen that with my client as well, the more potassium you can get out there, the better. And potassium does a couple of different things as well. When it's in the grass itself, it helps to move nitrogen around, which is fabulous. But it also is how the grass will manage its own wear, and it helps it to stand up. It gives it more turgidity. So what are you seeing when you're using that potassium, the higher potassium rate?
That's exactly it. You know, is our real mowing patterns aren't laying down as much.
Mm-hmm.
you're getting that, you know, even though with being on Primo, we're looking for, the horizontal growth, but we still want some vertical turgidity. And I do know that from having the sensors out there that monitor salt, the first couple of years here, I could watch after heavy rains. I could go back and look at the data and see the salt getting flushed through the potassium sulfate. Mm. It's quite interesting. So yeah, I don't hold potassium very well at all. So
that's pretty common.
It's pretty common
though with any sand field. I mean, it's almost as mobile as nitrogen is. Really,
well, and I think that's what we're finding. Yeah, I don't think people thought about potassium very much, and I started looking at it a lot more when I was in agriculture, and then I've been seeing it being echoed over in the turf side. We're seeing just how much that potassium plays in the game, how much it affects the turf itself, and how much it can affect your other fertility program, the rest of your fertility program, rather.
Now, obviously, we've been talking a lot about the grass, but the dirt plays equally a role in ball speed on the infield. And of course, the big key is you want to keep the speed consistent between the two. You don't want the ball, taking off when it hits the infield dirt after it's come off off the soil or the infield turf. Tell us about some of the things that you look at there.
Well, I mean, part of it is not letting your turf be compacted too much. So, that's going to help you on a soil-based or a sand-based field. But what we're trying to do is, for the middle infielders, is they have a certain rhythm they're looking for. So the speed of the ball from grass to dirt, we want that to kind of be consistent as much as it can. So if your grass is extremely fast and you've got a lot of top dressing on your dirt, that doesn't match up,
Right.
Or if you're mowing your cool season grass at inch and a half, inch and three quarters, and then you've got a firm dirt, well, that doesn't match up either. So it's a difficult thing to describe without actually having somebody watch the ground balls being hit, but there's a rhythm to turning double plays and that the infielders need to get into. And it's really a big issue with the shortstop and second baseman. The third baseman, third baseman's kind of reacting to things. The game is so fast, but for the middle infielders to be able to know that from a timing perspective, they're going to get a ball at a certain speed and that they've got time to make the decision, and especially a shortstop, even with nobody on base, he's got to have a mental clock in his head about how quick the ball is going to get to him and how fast the runner is and what he needs to do, how quick he needs to get rid of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I feel like, we set that mowing height in April and that's what we stick with. And the only way I'd really change it is if the manager, both middle infielders wanted us to.
Right.
But we'll do whatever the manager wants. But
well, and that brings us around, to the end. I mean, consistency is important, but one of your biggest philosophies is matching what your players and your manager want. Isn't that correct?
Right. And that can go against the grain of what you might think is the right thing for the turf grass. But at the major league level or in professional soccer, I think you have to make that adjustment as a turf manager and figure it out, and I'm pretty certain on the golf side, they've been doing that for a long time, they're going to have a tournament and the superintendent has to figure out what are tournament conditions for my greens? How do I do pre-stress conditioning for my greens to get it ready for this tournament, whether it's a local tournament or PGA tournament? So we're the same way in that if we had next year, for instance, if we had a new manager and new coaching staff and new general manager and a couple new players and they all want me to go in another direction with high to cut, then that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to argue with them. I'll just say, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll take care of you.
Yeah. It's interesting. You can get all these different opinions from 25 guys on the ball field, and the groundskeeper stuck there with, okay, who am I listening to?
Right.
And, you know, so my philosophy always was it had to come from a coach before I'd make a change, or the manager. Unless you got some big high-paid guy who really knows his stuff, like Cal Ripken or something like that, if they made a request, typically I took care of that. But otherwise, you'll drive yourself crazy trying to keep 25 guys happy because, well, one person wants, somebody else has got a different opinion on how it should be kept.
Yeah, and now, you know, nowadays in the game, we've got what they call a bench coach, which they might not have had 15 years ago. Everybody's got a bench coach now, so he's kind of the manager's right-hand man. With the manager having so many media things to deal with during homestands, and the third base coach is our third base coach is excellent. You know, they see things coaching third base right up close, you know, so they're valuable. You know, and then with players, it's, you know, how long has this guy been around? How long is he going to be around? You know, I know when we got started here, we had some new guys and we, you know, Justin Morneau had been here a while, and he was a key player and he was worth talking to. Even though he's a first baseman, I mean, he still was into what we were trying to do. And, you know, so you're right. You pick your spots, but to listen to everybody will drive you batty.
Well, on that note, I think we've pretty much covered a good portion here. The thing is, there's so much to take into account, and I really want to push people to go read the article that you wrote, Larry, because it's well written. It covers a comprehensive amount of information pertaining to ball speed. And while, yes, you write about mainly about sand-based fields, a lot of this also applies to native soil fields. Some of the things you'll have to adjust will be based on your soils for the native soil fields. But Larry, we appreciate you coming on and talking about this today, and hope people jump on and read your article about it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Rain. For a sports turf manager, it can be a godsend as it provides the needed water crucial to the life of your turf grass. But during baseball and softball seasons, it can be the thorn in your side on game days. Let Beacon relieve the pain of rainy game days with a full line of wet weather management tools to keep you in the game. Cover it up with Beacon's Field Shield 8-ounce tarps, available in all sizes from full infield to small area tarps. Anchor it down with Beacon's field weights and do away with those bulky, messy sandbags. Or use our new Pro Tarp Pins, so bright you won't lose these in your turf. Haul it off by using the Beacon Tarp Cart for moving and storing your mound and plate tarps off the field. Water on the field? Suck it up using Beacon's reusable puddle sponges, puddle pumps, or Diamond Pro Calcine Clay drying agents to get your games up and running again. Take the pain out of the rain and let Beacon help you. Call Beacon at 800-747-5985 to talk to our experienced staff, or check us out on the web at www.beaconathletics.com, where we're open 24/7 and ready to take your order.
And we're back. And I sure hope everyone else found that as fascinating as I do. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have him on, is because we honestly do have some very interesting discussions.
And of course, you find it interesting because he's your husband and you're required to say that.
Well, I married him because I find him interesting. Plus, his mom listens. I have to be very nice.
Apparently, I haven't married long enough yet.
No, I really like the way he approaches some of these things and the way he thinks about them. So.
Apparently, your daughter is very thrilled with him being on the show, too.
Well, and that's a good thing also. Hey, speaking of all of that, we are going to have some links up on our website, so come and check us out. We are going to have a link to Larry's article. It's a good read. It's over at Sports Turf, and
it's an excellent article. I'm not saying that to say anything more than that. It is a great article, and make sure you folks read everything in that article, because he gets pretty deep into things.
He does. So I think it's a fun read. So yeah, so we'll have a link to that up on the website, and I'm also going to have another link to the ASTM standards that Larry was talking about, and he's going to send us some pictures. We'll put those up as well. So there'll be a lot to come and see this week on our website.
Well, very good. Let's make sure everybody gets on and checks that out. And with that, we'll say that this show is in the books. And Darren, I'll read you one after we get off the show.
Well, don't miss a minute of our next show, too. There's lots of place to find us on the web, like we were just saying. You can go to our main page at beaconathletics.com/podcast. You're probably downloading our show through Apple iTunes. You can also find us at baseballtalkradio.com or baseballpodcast.net. Next week with Les Darren.
We'd love to hear from you. You can email Teresa and I or Darren at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your questions or comments on the show, good or bad. And if you have show ideas, send them along as well.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @DiamondDaVinci's. No squeal in there. Just @Diamond, DAVINCIS. We're not crazy active there, but you can check in with us, and we'd love to talk to you.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, I say good night, Darren.